The Avery case, Mr. Phillips, versus RGM again. Yeah, I remember them.
And, Your Honor, this is the case that I said I would waive argument on because this is the one that was lost on a 12B6 motion to dismiss, so there was no factual evidence developed here.
Well, this wasn't Lauer? I thought that was Lauer. With
well, I'm sure Lauer was, but all those cases were decided on a 12B6 motion to dismiss where the court basically said, there's no way you can, don't even bother to present evidence or a survey. So I'd like to concentrate my argument on the next group of cases, Jackson. That's where we have surveys and evidence. And if I can't win where I've done a survey and evidence, there's no point winning on the technicality of could they decide it on a motion to dismiss or not.
Oh. I see. You refer to... Okay, wait. I'm getting. My
we had Captain Arras. That was so an Indiana case.
We had Lauer and we had Captain.
And the settlement offer, but that was a 12B6.
We have two more, right?
Every RJM and its group. That's the Indiana pile of limited time cases. That was lost on a 12B6 motion to dismiss with no factual development.
So you want to talk about
Jackson?
Jackson
and Jackson, if we could, Your Honor.
Are the defendants' lawyers the same, or?
David Schultz for defendants.
Yes.
I am the lawyer, or at least the representative, or there are other lawyers here as well, for the 12B6 Indiana cases. Mm-hmm. And I'll be making the argument if there is one on that.
Yeah.
And then I'm also the lawyer solely in the Jackson summary judgment settlement letter cases. So I'm not sure. I hear what you say now. I prefer not to totally waive argument. There's a couple of points over my making in 12 cases.
Just save my time for rebuttal then, Your Honor.
So are you conceding on this case? Because
no.
That's what we need to have clear. You're just going to rest
on your
brief.
I'm waiving argument because
waive argument.
If I don't win the next group of cases, there's no point in remanding the every group of cases because I wouldn't do anything differently. Same survey, same evidence, and we would just lose later on after a lot of money.
Okay. That's fine. Okay, so you're going to waive your opening argument.
That's right.
And
if there's any
Mr.
unique
Schultz,
points,
right,
I'll
then
rebut.
You can have rebuttal. Sure, that's fine.
It's a little different position.
Not what you exactly planned for.
That's okay. That's fine. My name is David Schultz, and I represent two of the sets of defendants, the Asset and Midland defendants, in this group of cases, the captioned, I think, the Avery cases. At counsel's table is Mr. Messer, and he represents, I believe, RJM in those cases. And you heard from Mr. Hartzell, and he represents MRS in those cases. I will skip, I guess, a good part of my argument, but there are, I think, I wouldn't want the court to not need to rule or to not consider the Rule 12 cases, and I'm not sure that's what Mr. Phillips is saying. There are just two, I think, important points that need to be clarified that I'm not sure he's conceded, and that is, could the court consider, and was it appropriate to consider, the case on Rule 12, and could it consider both parts of the settlement argument on Rule 12? And when we get to the first question, which could the court consider the case on Rule 12, the reason that's raised is because, as you see on page 13 of their opening brief, they make the argument that based on Seventh Circuit case law, if they simply say something is false, misleading, and confusing, that's all they need to do. They should be able to go forward. And what I think needs, I think it's clear in the law. I think your cases are clear, but there seems certainly to be a dispute about that. And I think what the test is and the standard you've articulated and what I'd like to be clear is the test, and I think the district court judges would prefer to know that this is the test. I think now from these settlement cases we've sort of gotten there. We may not have been there, though, because as you saw, Judge Castillo and Judge Holderman were perhaps maybe a little unclear whether they could take a Rule 12. And then later the cases started going that way. And I think the test, if there is one, should be, and I believe it is. You know, I'm thinking of the Taylor case that you authored in the Chue case, for instance. There are certainly some cases you can look at, false misleading, and probably almost all the FDCPA sections, where it's clear it's a violation. And you've come down with case law that is guidance for that in the court, and at a Rule 12 motion, a district court judge should be able to rule. And now we have the, in the Seventh Circuit anyhow, the other area, and that is where there might be a question of fact of some sort. And this court has developed a survey-type standard for that. And I believe that's the middle area. It might be a vast middle area, but it is a middle area. It is not everything else, though. And that's what should be clear. It's not everything else. Because it seems to me that you've articulated a standard that in a situation where, and I believe the exact language is, if it's an unrealistic, if it's a peculiar, if it's bizarre, or if it's idiosyncratic, I prefer just to go with peculiar, that seems easiest way, that in those situations, and these cases appear to be those situations, the court does have authority.
Well, certainly the basic question in these cases, realistically, the judge looks at the letter and sees whether it's, you know, arguably misleading and so on. So, you know, that, call that 12b-6, that's no problem. But what if Mr. Phillips wants to present survey evidence to show that these settlement offers, although maybe we as lawyers would think they were perfectly innocuous, are really, you know, perniciously misleading? Well, what's the basis for blocking that?
I'm not saying there is a basis for blocking that. What I'm saying is that would then fall within the what I believe is the middle, perhaps vast middle, category. But
well, if there's no basis for blocking it, then how can we affirm? I don't understand.
No, I'm saying that you can affirm if the court looks at it and decides this is a peculiar, this is a bizarre, this is an idiosyncratic interpretation.
I
can grant a motion.
I don't think you're listening to me. He has these surveys that, I mean, they may not be very good or what have you, but he wants to present surveys to show that, in fact, whatever we might think, this settlement offer letter is misleading. Now, what is the basis for preventing him from presenting that evidence?
I believe the basis for presenting him is if the case...
What is it about this case that makes it possible for us to block his survey evidence?
I was thinking of the standard.
I'll go to application
of the standard. I do not believe. I think to complain that this is, and we're only dealing with confusing and misleading. To complain that a letter is confusing and misleading, I say, well, what about if the letter is confusing and misleading? And he says the thing that's confusing and misleading about the letter is that somebody who gets a letter with a date on it thinks that that's the only time they have to negotiate. And that is bizarre because, in my mind, none of the letters say anything about what could happen in the future. What they do say is this, right now, this offer is being made. This offer is being made, and it's good until this date. And to sit there and say that somehow precludes anything in the future from being negotiated, or that they will talk about settlement in the future, or that they may, especially in the NAFS case, for instance.
Well, it says, you know, we would like to offer you a unique opportunity to satisfy your outstanding debt.
Right.
Well, suppose the unsophisticated consumer thinks, well, unique opportunity, wow, I got to take advantage of this, right?
Right.
Or else it wouldn't be unique if it's a continuing opportunity. I'm not saying that's a sensible interpretation, but
might
someone think that?
That's a fine interpretation, that this is a unique opportunity. You've been offered a settlement, and it's fine to think that this is a unique opportunity. But to then skip to the next step, which is what they're doing, is saying, and by the way, you're never going to get another settlement letter from us. By the way, you're never going to be able to negotiate this debt. That is bizarre. That is not what the letters say at all. That is a stretch that no judge has ever looked at the letter says.
The other one says, please mail your payment no later than June 7th, 2004 in order to receive credit for the 50% off discount by the expiration date. So it sounds as if, you know, your 50% discount offer is time limited. If it expires on June 7th. So
on
May 7th. So some unsophisticated person doesn't know about settlements and, you know, game theory and all that, might say, wow, I got to do this or I'm going to have to pay 100%.
That's fine. And to take advantage of that offer at that time,
okay. That's
fine. That they can view the letter that way. It doesn't mean, though, that somehow they are confused and misled to think there will never be something else. Judge Holt.
I don't understand you. I offered you an interpretation under which... I mean, suppose it said limited time offer. That would be different. But suppose the unsophisticated interpret this as a limited time offer. Then what?
Then they're interpreting.
Then your goose is cooked. So why can't they have a survey in order to see whether consumers interpret these as limited time offers?
It's fine if they interpret it as a limited time offer, but that interpretation doesn't mean that there may never be another offer or that they may be able to extend that offer.
No, that's what a limited time means. Good only now, you know. 50% until May 7th, after that, forget it.
There's no meaning to a
limited time offer that has an unlimited time, right?
Well,
so all you're saying, all your argument is doing is really showing we need surveys or some other evidence to figure out what people make of this.
Well, I think Judge Haldeman's comment, and I think it's true from all the plaintiffs in here, that is not the situation that the unsophisticated consumer or the consumers that are getting debt collection letters are in. It is reasonable to assume that they know that there's going to be further collection letters and there's going to be further settlement offers.
Why do you say it's reasonable to assume that?
I think from common experience and from the record in these cases.
Who, your common experience?
I think from a common experience from the cases that I've seen.
Common experience in cases?
That the situation in which you're subject to debt collection activity, it is common that there are going to be series of letters and there are going to be series of offers.
Well, if you're a deadbeat, sure, but maybe this is the first such letter you've got. You're not an experienced deadbeat.
I think that would certainly be the... That would probably be more of the aberration in connection with the types of consumers.
An aberration? There must be a first time even for a deadbeat.
Correct. I'm sure there's...
There must be a first letter, right?
I'm sure there's a first letter at some point, but if we're looking at protect consumers generally, protect unsophisticated consumers generally, if that's
so
the
maybe
test.
Maybe there are some people, they receive the first letter, they think it's a limited time offer, they pay. They're suckers. They don't realize, you know, you're supposed to ignore these letters.
Well, I'm not sure that necessarily makes it misleading and confusing to them. Or the point being, the other point I want to make, though, before
You go to that, you're talking about these cases you're relying on. Has there been survey evidence in other cases dealing with the same language of these offers that were made? Because you're saying it's reasonable, it makes sense, et cetera, et cetera. Have there been surveys?
No, I'm saying this from real experience,
right,
in there. By the time you're getting to this situation, and they actually plead too in their briefs. They say, and not plead in their briefs, but they comment on this. These consumers are typically subject to many collection activities at the same time. This is not unusual at all in this circumstance. And it's not unusual. It'd be impractical to use that scenario that you're talking about compared to just about every other one I've seen.
There's always a first time. Everybody gets a first, right?
Right, but I'm not sure.
So what do you know about how people respond the first time? You don't know. No one knows.
I can't say I definitely know how everybody responds the first time, but I'm talking about a statute that's meant to be used to regulate conduct generally, and in this not generally, but to consumers. The other quick point I want to make, if I could, is simply that for false, and these cases dealt with confusing, misleading, and false, there's no need for a survey, and it was correct for the judges to decide that issue in my mind.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Schultz. Mr. Phillips?
To the first point the counsel raised, we didn't take the position that you could never, ever dismiss a case on a 12B6 motion. I think the Bell Atlantic case from the Supreme Court makes that clear. I think if you did have a collection letter that just had consumer's name, the amount of debt, all the bells and whistles of the notices, and then someone filed a suit and said, this lawsuit threatens to kill me, of course you could dismiss it, or you could do a judgment on the pleadings. That's not the position we ever took. I'd note that page 3 of our reply brief, that's explicit what we said, so that's not the issue here. We did plead a recognized cause of action. We said that discovery likely will show that these offers are false, that they're not limited in time or duration. That's the same thing, time, duration, or as to these amounts. Based on our experience, we also told the court explicitly we wanted to present a survey. It does state a claim, but it goes back to what I said, which is if everything we did in the next group of cases isn't enough and could never win, then there's no point in winning here. because we would just lose later on after great expense. Are there any other questions? Otherwise, I'd save all the settlement offer for my opening in the next case, Your Honors.
Okay, that's fine, Mr. Phillips. And thank you, Mr. Oakes. So we'll move directly to the last case.